It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strandchamps. It's the holiday season, so chances are you're shopping for presents. The kids want new hoodies or Lego sets. Your mom wants yet another gardening tool. And then there are the gifts that people wish they didn't have to ask for.
So my dad, his name is Jay Costello. He and my mom live in Heartland, Wisconsin, just outside of the Milwaukee area. When he was 56, he was diagnosed with multiple myeloma.
This is Meg Costello, and this is the story of the year her family had to ask for a really big gift.
Survival rates for myeloma in people with his form of myeloma is 3 to 5 years. If patients with myeloma respond to chemotherapy treatments, they go in for a stem cell transplant. The way my dad has always kind of described it to people is it's like a Control-Alt-Delete on your system. Our whole family was just trying to, like, prepare for this, quite frankly, massive operation and his recovery, which would be 6 months to a year. I don't remember his first bills, but I believe my mom has now told me he's over the $3 or $5 million mark. One of the drugs he's on now is like $30,000 a month. And so there's, of course, a financial bit of turmoil. I work in fundraising, and so I have a little bit of benefit in just knowing that when people feel called to do something, they give money. And so I had just said to my mom, you know, what can I do? She just said, I don't know. And then I just thought to myself, I know what I can do. We put together a GoFundMe fundraiser. Anything you can give would make a difference. I just was clear and to the point. My dad is in the hospital and will be in the hospital for maybe 20 days. My mom is not working and she is on FMLA. Thanks for considering. I don't really remember the first donation, but I remember I set it up that morning before I went into work. Mid-morning, maybe by 10 o'clock, my sister said, there's 8 people who've made a gift. And I was like, yes. She said, I can't believe it. And I said, we're not done yet, just wait. You're watching this almost like stock ticker of people, their comments and their names and their support coming in. Good job, Jay, go get them, and keep your heads up, Costellos, and keep going. And it feels like Mario on the Mario Brothers. He gets like a little gold coin, and it just, I remember feeling like we got it, like this is great. I believe I set the goal up for $5,000, and then we hit it. And I said, well, I know how this works. I'm increasing it. Which, of course, my mom then was, like, mortified. And I was like, no, no, no. People want to do this. Like, we're increasing this. People who I wouldn't even maybe see once a year, or a colleague who I've never really talked to other than he or she might know my dad was sick, could give $20 or $50 or $100. At the end, we ended up getting a little bit over $10,000. It was incredible. I mean, my whole family was just stunned. Absolutely stunned.
So I want to ask you about your relationship to gratitude and to all those people, because so many people came forward and contributed money or their time or groceries or whatever. Do you feel like you owe them something?
I think what I would say, and our whole family would say, is we felt we needed to pay it forward to those individuals. I mean, we're probably talking 200 people at this point that have kind of weighed in. And so my middle sister and I worked to put together a master spreadsheet for my mom, because she just said, I have to do something to thank these people. Like, I have to give them some sense that they made a difference. And then during Christmas, we had a family Christmas card taken just to say, thank you. Here's a picture of my dad. He was wearing a cool bandana because he didn't have hair. And our family and the dog, and just saying, you know, thank you on behalf of our family for being with us during a crazy amount of 3 years that feels like 3 lifetimes worth.
What does your dad say about what all of that has meant to him?
I think in some ways he can't even really fathom it. And it's odd because for a lot of it, he was kind of out of it. he doesn't really know what was going on. Now he just kind of thinks like, that was pretty amazing, wasn't it? And I'm like, yes, Dad, that was very amazing. We're not quiet people. We're kind of loud, lots of cursing. My dad's a retired lieutenant colonel, hunter, fisher. You know, he's like a Wisconsin dad archetype, no filter. And so I think one of the things that was continues to be a big part of just us and how we've been dealing with this is to incorporate humor into it. I can tell you some other things we say, but they would need to be bleeped out, our family mottos. So part of that, I think, was a struggle on how do we communicate, quite frankly, the severity of many situations we went through with humor.
I think I know your answer to this. I'm guessing. But, you know, your dad is an example of how much longer people can live now with terminal disease, which is wonderful. But as you move from one treatment to another, they get increasingly advanced and increasingly expensive. Is there a point at which you feel like, I can't ask people again?
That's a good question. I don't know what we will do next time. I know that we're going to need help. I never thought I'd be putting together like a dad babysitting sign-up list. That was one of the weirdest things I've ever done in my life. Sometimes when I see things happening, I just remember how much people continue to help us all the time with little things and big things too. But it's incredibly rewarding to remember those things. I don't know how we'll ask people to help us again or how I'll feel about it. I know that we have to, because I just know that we cannot do this alone. There's no way. You can't.
That both breaks my heart and makes me happy. Meg says her father, Jay Costello, has had 2 stem cell transplants. He's in remission now, but the family knows that at some point in the future, he'll relapse. So this hour, we're talking about how giving and receiving, both of them, can be complicated. For example, what about the gift that you didn't ask for and also maybe didn't want? Hadar Copley Woods thinks about this a lot. She has MS, and she's in a wheelchair, so people do her favors all the time without asking. For them, you know, this is a nice thing to do. For her, it can feel patronizing. She resents it, but she also feels guilty about resenting it. Giving and receiving. Complicated.
I have a pretty wildly fluctuating condition that causes me to... Well, sometimes I walk around with no aid. Sometimes I need crutches, and sometimes I need a wheelchair.
I mean, how does it affect you from day to day?
Well, it's definitely real and present in my life. It's been slowly, increasingly real and present in my life for about the past 4 years, so I'm relatively new to it. It affects me in that I am most of the time seen as a disabled person by everyone around me.
Did you notice any changes in the way people interact with you when you first started using the crutches and the wheelchair?
Oh, yes. Yes. That is where the unwanted help began.
What do you mean by unwanted help?
If you were to see someone easily and fluidly opening a door and walking through it, you would probably not suddenly panic and say, I'll get that, run over, fling the door open, and then stand in their way. But if the person was in a wheelchair, you just might. You might find yourself doing that. And that's the sort of unwanted help I mean, either panicking and obstructing a disabled person who's trying to just go through their day, or opening a door perfectly helpfully when the person was capable of doing it themselves. There's so much of being disabled that genuinely makes me feel helpless. It's very important to me to be able to do the things that I can do. Very often when I'm in the chair, I will have people run over and push the elevator button for me. But sitting in a wheelchair doesn't actually affect your ability to push an elevator button.
It's people offering to help and thereby patronizing you that you find actually more irritating than people, say, ignoring you or avoiding you?
There's so much about being disabled that involves society's assumptions that you are helpless and that you need to be an object of charity. I've actually had people come up behind me and grab the back of my chair and start pushing without saying a word, which is really shocking and upsetting. Imagine if you were walking upstairs and someone just thought you needed a boost. Pretty much most people who approach me assuming that what defines me is what I cannot do, that's emotionally exhausting.
So what do you do when people make these unwanted offers of help?
And it depends on the day, and it depends on the person. There have been several times that people, perhaps elderly people, society treats them as if they are helpless. When one of them wants to open a door for me, I am very often extremely gracious because I know they finally are getting the chance to open a door for someone else. Most of the time, I'm not the kind of crip who's going to lecture a stranger. Most of the time, I grit my teeth and I try to be pleasant.
You don't think that people are sometimes simply trying to be kind and just are being very awkward about it?
You saying that reminds me of a time that I remember with keen regret when I was able-bodied, and I knew myself enough at the time to know that if I were to become disabled, I would really resent strangers constantly helping me when I didn't need it. And I was driving down the street. I still remember exactly what street it was. And there was a man in a manual wheelchair struggling against what had been a very sudden snowstorm. And I saw him and I thought, I don't want to insult him by offering help. And I kept driving. I wish I could go back to that moment and at least pull over and offer to help.
I wonder, how much are these questions talked about in the disability community? For instance, did anybody ever give you advice about how to respond when a stranger grabs your chair?
This is almost constantly discussed. A lot of times we'll just sort of share these stories because sometimes it's hard for someone who isn't disabled to understand how angering an interaction like that can be. And so we'll tell each other and then we'll sort of laugh. And sometimes we will ask for advice. And it's very hard based on your personality, based on what region you live in, based on how accessible your town is. It seems like there's a different way to deal with it. Minneapolis is an incredibly accessible town, except for the snow. If you live in some older towns or in towns that do not enforce the ADA quite as well, you might need a lot more help from strangers, maybe to get over curbs and things like that.
Are there ways in which people can offer to help that do work for you?
I think that it's very individual. In my mind, if at all possible, imagining that a person with a disability does not have a disability and just watching for struggle and offering to help seems to make most sense. There have been times when I have definitely needed help if I'm in my wheelchair or in one of those scooters at the drugstore or something, and I need something on a top shelf. There is something that I think binds us together when I ask a person who's just walking along, would you lend me a hand? Would you mind getting down that aspirin for me from the shelf? And they say, sure, and they get it down. And I feel good that someone cared enough to help me when it wasn't their job, and they feel good that they could connect to another person in this way. And I think that is a wonderful way of connecting and of helping each other. When you are genuinely helping people with what they really need, it's part of what makes us human. It's part of how we became human.
It sounds to me like you're somebody who really values your independence. Has it been a challenge to learn how to ask?
Yes. I think it's really important to almost every American that I know, being independent. For me in particular, I'm an extremely, extremely physical person, and I still am. I still work out probably more than most. I know that my physicality is part of what attracted my spouse, and especially when I first became disabled, that was difficult, not because my husband liked me any less, but because I was afraid that it would change who I was in a really fundamental way. It turns out that it didn't, but I do need to ask for help. And having only been disabled for 4 years, my house is still set up for an able-bodied person. So if I'm having a bad night and I need to be in the wheelchair, I need to ask for help to get almost everything down. Just in basic things, like if I want a drink of water, I need to ask my spouse to get me down a glass. And I don't like that. I don't like that at all. And it makes me feel like less of an adult. Even though it's necessary, I really need that drink of water. And then there are times when I'm hit so badly that I need him to help me drag me up the stairs, frankly, so I can get to bed. And asking for that help and then receiving that help from someone with whom you have a sexual relationship, really, that takes some negotiating.
What does he say?
Jan is kind of an amazing person. He is always willing to help. We've had a few moments where I became angry that he didn't anticipate something that I would need. I always need my wheelchair in museums, for instance, and he very kindly loaded the wheelchair into the car for me. And when we got there, I saw that he had not checked the tires, and you really need to fill them every time. And he hadn't done that. And I yelled at him, oh, this is so embarrassing to remember. I was just so angry that he hadn't anticipated that need for me. So I've started kind of taking for granted that he's just going to assume certain things. So we're still kind of negotiating those sorts of things.
Is part of the difficulty for you in being able to ask for help that it feels humiliating?
Yes. Yes, it definitely does. I mean, MS is a progressive disease. I'm assuming that I'm going to be needing more and more help. And I hope that we'll be in a financial situation where I can actually hire people to do some of the really, really personal, intimate things that I would just prefer that my spouse didn't do. I feel like having a barrier between those two things will help me to feel as if we're in a more equal relationship. But we might not be able to afford it. He might need to be doing a lot of very intimate bathing, bathroom kind of things for me as we get older. I'm very nervous about that. I think that when you're in an ongoing relationship with someone, when one person is doing almost all of the helping, it's very hard not to constantly feel beholden. And I still haven't figured out how to negotiate that. And that's a very uncomfortable place to be in.
Sounds like it's a question of grace. How to accept a gift or help with grace.
Yes, I mean, it's very similar to being able to accept a compliment. I've learned how to do that. And so I'm confident that I will learn how to negotiate this with Jan. But so far, I'm still working on it.
Hadar Copley-Woods has been living with MS since 2007. Hadar's story demonstrates that helping someone can be a lot more complicated than you'd think. Which raises another question. Is it actually possible to give a truly selfless gift? Anthropologist David Graeber says it's not only impossible. He says the entire idea of a free gift is nothing but a construct born in opposition to impersonal market economies. In other words, it's, you know, complicated. As Steve Paulson discovered.
Why is the culture of gift-giving so complicated?
Well, because we define gifts so broadly. A gift is simply anything that you give to someone where you're not demanding anything in return. It doesn't mean you're not even expecting something, but there's no explicit contractual demand that you'll get something back. If someone asks you for a cigarette or a light, for that matter, or if you present tribute to a feudal lord or something to impress a superior in our own culture, those are completely different things, but we just lump them together as gifts.
There has been a rich anthropological tradition of studying gift giving, and I know one of the pioneers in this investigation was Marcel Mauss, mm-hmm. who wondered whether there really ever is such a thing as a true gift, a gift given with no self-interest whatsoever. Is there any evidence that a true gift is possible?
Well, sure. I mean, it all depends on how you define it. If someone is begging on the street and you give them some money, you can create a story whereby you're getting something out of it. But really, you don't expect anything in return. What Mauss was really getting at is not so much that there is no such thing as a free gift, but the very idea that there could be such a thing as a free gift seems to be this kind of strange mirror of the market. Because if you don't have a system where you say, all right, we have this place where everybody's simply trying to get as much stuff as possible for themselves and not thinking about anyone else, then it's almost impossible to imagine the opposite. And in fact, historically, that's exactly what you get. Where you get the invention of coinage and markets, you get the invention of world religions at exactly the same times and places where people start talking about charity and free gifts. But you can't have one without the other.
So the whole culture of gift-giving changes totally once money enters into the picture?
I think that's what Most was really trying to get at. The question isn't, can you give a pure gift? The question is, why would we even imagine that it would be either possible or desirable to do so? One of the classic examples from a Danish writer named Peter Freudchen, who lived amongst Inuit in Greenland for a while. People there had this terrible aversion to saying thank you. You know, we'd go on a hunt, he wouldn't get anything, someone else would. Guy would show up with a ton of walrus meat or some present like that. And he said, oh, thank you so much. And he said, don't say that. You know, if you're saying thank you, it's like, you know, you're saying you owe me something. And that's wrong because we're humans. And humans, well, we help each other out. We say here, gifts make slaves like whips make dogs. So if you say thank you, you're saying it's a gift and I owe you. So that's bad. What we do is we share. If you live in a society where you don't have impersonal markets, that's what you find. You know, you give somebody something, but you might be doing it to help them. You might be doing it to get them in your debt in some way. You might be doing it because you hate them and you want to humiliate them by being more generous and showing up that they need the help. There's a million different motives, and you can't boil it down to, you know, simple greed or simple selflessness.
So what comes with a gift is an obligation that you are to give something in return.
An obligation that you'll give someone something in return, or recognition that you're inferior. So very often, it's quite intense, the feelings that can be raised by someone giving a gift that cannot be paid back. Another story I like to tell, well, there's two. One's actually from Most. He found it in a Greek author named Posidonius about Celtic nobles. They would have these contests, and they'd duel, and they'd try to outdo each other in games of various sorts. But one of the games was to try to give each other gifts of various glorious types that the other couldn't repay. And if you get into a situation of complete checkmate, someone gives you something so great that you couldn't possibly ever answer their gift, the only really honorable thing to do would be to commit suicide. And then your wealth is distributed to your flunkies.
Now, is that just a sort of a literary example, or is there some reality behind that story?
Who knows? I imagine it might have happened once or twice. But here's another side of the same thing. In one of the Icelandic sagas, there's this wonderful story about these two Vikings named Einar and Egil. And they like to write poems together. One day, Egil shows up with a beautiful shield that he's gotten on a raid, something no one's ever seen before. His friend isn't there, so he leaves it as a present, rides off. The guy shows up about 12 hours later and sees this shield hanging there and says, my God, what's this? And they says, oh, yeah, your friend Egil left it for you. It's a present. And he takes one look at it and says, aha. So this guy thinks that I'm going to spend all night writing a poem celebrating his generosity. The hell of it, I'll kill him. So he gets on the horse, rides off, tries to catch up with him, but fortunately the guy has a lead. So at the end of the day, he gives up, goes home, and writes a poem about how great a guy that Einar is.
So there's all, I mean, so implicit within this is there's the one-upsmanship of gift giving, and we've probably experienced that at one point or another in our own lives.
Right. You feel that somehow you're less of a person if you can't respond with something at least as good and probably just a little bit better. And this is one of the things that Most was fascinated with because, as he pointed out, it's not something that only occurs in the ancient world. It affects all of us. Even though our theories about how the world works tells us it shouldn't really be true. So if you take a free market economist out to dinner, he's going to feel that he really has to do the same to you, even though his theory says he should think, well, gee, I got something for nothing. Great. Why do you have that feeling?
But those expectations seem to vary so much from culture to culture. Is there something freeing about this? You know, let's do away with kind of this elaborate system of social obligations. Let's just make this a financial transaction.
Well, it can be. I mean, anyone who grows up in a traditional society knows that it's a little oppressive to constantly have to think about what your neighbors think of you. On the other hand, there's the upside, which is that you'll always have food. The problem with market relations is that there's winners and losers, and the losers can be in very bad shape. So that in most what they call gift economies, phrase that Marcel Mauss invented, there's a kind of bottom line where it's not even a question of exchange. Some things you just share. We need to recognize that that's always the case. The basis of human sociality, if you're not an enemy, on a certain level, everybody's going to be a communist with one another. And the sense of if the need is great enough, like I'm drowning, or if the cost is small enough, like do you have a light? Well, it's expected that if you have a need and they have an ability, they'll help you out. What we've done is we've driven that baseline sociability to an incredibly minimal level. So I think that one thing we can learn from gift economies, we need to ratchet that up a little bit.
Now, you have been involved quite recently with the Occupy Wall Street movement, and I know you've participated in other direct actions against various global economic forums. Does this question of gift giving play a role in this whole issue as we see the problems with the global monetary and economic system?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it's significant. I've written about this, that one of the first things that people do in pretty much any occupation, you know, first they establish a place to sleep, but the next thing they do is they create a library. Could we start from the idea of the library and come up with a totally different model of how goods and services could circulate? And I think people are playing around with that. I know there's working groups in New York trying to imagine a new alternative form of currency which would be inspired by the idea of the gift.
David Graeber is an anthropologist who has written a lot of books. The most recent are The Utopia of Rules and BS Jobs. Steve Paulson was talking with him. If there's no such thing as a free gift, what does that say about people who give really big gifts? I'm talking $100 million gifts. Are billionaire philanthropists saving the world?
You know, at the heart of our age is this idea that we live in this time in which rich people talk a great deal about saving us and changing the world and making a difference, but are in fact building and operating and maintaining a system that is destroying the American dream for most Americans. It's hard to think about someone who captures that better for me than David Rubenstein of the Carlyle Group, a private equity firm out of Washington.
On behalf of the National Park Service, I'd like to welcome you to National Mall and Memorial Parks.
You're most likely to hear about him today as a patriotic philanthropist. He buys stuff for the government that the government couldn't afford. An old copy of the Magna Carta, 13th Amendment, and then he'd donate it to National Archives or to other government agencies.
It is a true pleasure to introduce a man with who has great respect for American history. Ladies and gentlemen, a true patriot, David Rubenstein.
When the Washington Monument was damaged by an earthquake in 2011, a crack down the middle, perfect metaphor for everything that was happening in Washington, David Rubenstein stepped up when the government was unable to pay half of the $15 million bill.
I only did what other Americans who have the good fortune that I have had would have done, presented with the same opportunity.
One of the things that's less well known about him is that he and his firm and his industry have pushed very hard for something called the carried interest loophole.
Many Americans have had good fortune. I have had good fortune.
Which is a special tax benefit for very wealthy financiers that basically allows them to be taxed at a much lower rate than their secretaries, as Warren Buffett famously put it.
I really wanted to give back to the country.
So you have a guy who has fought for this tax break that by some estimates costs the U.S. government $18 billion a year.
This was just a down payment on my obligation to repay the country for what it has done for me and for my family.
And then gets with a little fraction of that money to the government for these little projects.
I hope to do other things that will help repay.
Gets rebranded as a patriotic philanthropist.
I hope other Americans will take up the banner and also begin to participate in what I'd like to call patriotic philanthropy.
He's had the audacity to say,
the federal government doesn't have the money to do everything it would like to do and can't do everything it did in the past.
Rich guys like me have to step up. At the heart of what I'm critiquing is not simply what David Rubenstein or the Carlyle Group does, but what we do as a society when we turn someone like him into a philanthropist instead of a moral debtor who should be begging for our mercy.
Whoa. More on that in a minute. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRX. It's December, the giving season, and every charity out there is doing their year-end fund drive. So giving money to charity is a good thing to do, right? Unselfish, compassionate, part of being a good citizen. Well, maybe for you and me, writing checks for $50 here and there. But then there are the people who write checks for millions and millions, and those gifts often come with strings, and they just might be a lot less altruistic than they appear. Anand Giridharadas is the author of Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. When Shannon Henry Kleiber talked with him, they started in the Middle Ages.
There was a thing you could buy called the papal indulgence. And what that allowed you to do was live a bad life. And in time before the buzzer went off, pay some money and get kind of guaranteed passage to heaven. And what a lot of these rich folks are doing in our time is a form of secular papal indulgence.
You talk about this as predatory philanthropy. This is something that is pretty dark.
Well, there's a whole spectrum. And I don't want to suggest that there isn't philanthropy that's good. A tremendous amount of philanthropy does good. Most of it does good at the margin and helps people and saves lives. And no one is questioning that. You know, I think $410 billion was given away philanthropically in this country within recent years. And none of what I have been banging the drum about with Winners Take All, none of it is about saying, is giving back a noble thing or are people really helped or not? There are some questions about the effectiveness of particular programs. But in general, giving is a noble impulse and helping people is a noble impulse. What I am raising a question about is our system, a system that is built on a winners take all economy in which people at the top of the game of capitalism practice an extreme form of it, unseen in most other rich countries, that is essentially a slash-and-burn form of capitalism, a very particular form of it in which you basically, you know, break the environment if that's what it takes to make a profit. You break workers' backs if that's what it takes to make a profit. You break the system of social mobility in America if that's what it takes to make a profit. You break the kind of ability of people to have stable, predictable lives if that's what it takes to make a profit. You source from China and various other places without any kind of labor protections, thus gutting your own working class in your own country if that's what it takes to make a profit. And then, having done very well because of that, because you saved some money or made extra money because of those kinds of slash-and-burn tactics, then, with that money, in the time of reading glasses and grandchildren, you turn around and you become a philanthropist. You start a foundation. You give back. And what I'm trying to suggest is that this model of slashing and burning and then giving back generously is an insane model for a country like ours, because for many reasons. First of all, the people who do the slashing and burning almost never are able to compensate for the amount of slashing and burning through their giving back. It is impossible for a Goldman Sachs foundation to do the amount of giving that it would take to do to repair what the role they played in causing the financial crisis.
The motivation is not just to change things to make that person happier. Is it legacy? What is that motivation?
I think there are a lot of genuine elites out there who truly feel lucky and blessed and want to make a difference for others. And I think in their case, they're often naive about the following, which is they want to make a difference. They want to do anything they can to advance social justice, except getting off the backs of people shut out by power. So they're willing to do anything except question their own undue privileges, except question the school system that allows their school kids to have better schools than other people's schools, except by questioning the tax regime that allows them to pay a much lower tax rate than their secretary. And so that's a kind of naive motivation set. And you find a lot of that in Silicon Valley, where there's this kind of earnest desire to change the world, but I don't want my world to change. I don't want the government regulating me. And that's what you see in Facebook and others. Then I think you have another corner of this, which is a totally cynical motivation. I wrote a piece in The New Yorker about a great email that was unearthed from Goldman Sachs in 2007, in which it was realizing that The New York Times was about to break a story about its shady mortgage industry shenanigans, which would eventually help contribute to the financial crisis. And on that day, when word of that story was traveling around the bank, you know, an email went out saying, hey, we should really make sure we're pitching them on our GS Gives program. And there was a clear recognition, if you parse that email, that when you are being seen in the world as doing a bad thing, you should talk about your philanthropic giving, right? So that's the opposite end, where it's just totally cynical. Giving is a lubricant in the engine of continued taking.
When I covered this world in Washington, D.C., the people who were making the technology money then ran for public office. They were the philanthropists. They were buying the sports teams. They were running D.C. I mean, it's still like that. If they're not changing the world, who will?
We, us, people, movements, the way we changed the world in the past. The reality is we've forgotten the heritage of how we make change in this country. And we've always made the most important changes from below through movements of the people demanding justice, demanding the expansion of rights. And what has happened in recent years is people like the people you mentioned, people who've made a lot of money in business, have decided that they are experts on whatever they want to be experts on. I always joke, you never get in a car with a philanthrocapitalist because they do not know how to stay in their lane. They swerve all the way across the highway of life. If you've had a little bit of success in a niche telecom business or some kind of car parts manufacturing, you immediately think, you know what? I made $50 million in car parts. I'm pretty qualified to rethink the public schools in Dayton. I think my opinions are of some significance. That's what happens to a lot of these rich guys. And, I have to say, it is often guys who overestimate their own ability to be experts on everything just because they made money in one thing. And they're able to then translate that kind of what may begin as an annoying cocktail party thing of a rich guy having thoughts on education suddenly morphs into a rich guy having power over how America educates public school children, because that rich guy will get on the board of an organization or will start a charter school or in some cases run for office. I think among the spectrum of things you can do running for office is actually a little bit better, because at least you're submitting yourself to the will of the people. However, you're often spending a lot of your own money in essentially buying people's votes. I think what we need to think about in this country is how to reduce the voice of rich people. And if you are a rich person who wants to make America better, honestly, and you're listening to this, ask yourself, how can I reduce the volume of my voice? How can I be less heard? How can my opinions ramify less far? It's not a question we often ask ourselves in America, but it's very clear if you look at our winners-take-all economy and society that this society has heavily overweighted the voices of rich people and heavily underweighted the voices of everybody else.
So this is so interesting to think about, that rich people listening to this will change the way they think or change the way they do things. I can imagine not being one of them. And I can imagine they're thinking, if they're listening to this,
give it time. Public radio is totally
the way to go. I can imagine they're thinking, well, what am I supposed to do with my money and my influence, right?
Thank you for asking. Look, the simple kind of pithy advice I give to folks who want to give better is to shift from giving back to giving up. You know, giving back is standing on top of an indefensible mountain and throwing a couple of gold coins down. By the way, when Jeff Bezos announced his philanthropic kind of initiative recently, the founder of Amazon, I wrote a piece suggesting what shifting from giving back to giving up would look like for him. Giving back is what he's doing right now. It's, you know, creating some Montessori schools, helping the homeless. Totally noble, fine, it'll help some people. But I said it'd be much more ambitious for him to give up. What if he were to actually invest $1 billion or $2 billion in the future of worker power in this country, in the future of organizations trying to build stronger unions and figure out the future of collective bargaining? That would be a kind of giving that would put his own privilege at risk. Mm-hmm. That might take the stock down of Amazon. That might reduce his net worth. But he was only able to build Amazon because he got lucky and built it in a moment, which he didn't cause, but he inherited, a moment of particularly low worker power in this country. And he knows that. Jeff Bezos should give in ways to ensure that there's never another Jeff Bezos.
This makes me think that the biggest challenge in what you're talking about might be ego.
Not for the first time in history is that the biggest challenge in a conversation. Absolutely. And I think it's as simple as seeing the fact that giving in this country so often comes with putting your name on something. I will say very simply here on this show, and NPR has a complicated relationship to this very topic, that I don't think giving should come with your name on it. I think if you're truly generous, you should make sure your name is not on it. If you're putting your name on a gift, on a building, on whatever, you're purchasing something. You're not giving. You're giving over here and you're buying your name on something. And when your friends see your name on that wall, they might think the better of you. You're purchasing something. And by the way, we are all subsidizing that through tax breaks that allow you to buy esteem in your community. So I think when folks give, it should be anonymous. It's actually something in the Jewish tradition that requires that of a certain kind of giving. I think that should be actually the default for everybody. You have to ask yourself, if you're giving and you want to be associated with it, why? What are your motivations? Are you simply trying to do what you need to do for that organization or for the community? Or are you in it for yourself? By the way, if you do get a naming right, why do so many people put their own name? Why can't they, you know, name it the Rosa Parks Library or the Rosa Parks Auditorium? I mean, it's extraordinary how many people, it doesn't occur to them to put someone else's name, a name of someone who would be a hero and would inspire people on the wrong side of power to challenge systems and structures, instead of putting their own tired name that doesn't need any more exposure on yet another building.
Anand Giridharadas is the author of Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World. Shannon Henry Kleiber talked with him. Don't go away. Up next, we will prove the old adage that it is better to give than to receive through dodgeball. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. We've talked a lot about the dark side of giving this hour. So let's get back in the holiday mood and talk about something happier. You. If you're a mom, like me, you've been spending a lot of time thinking about and shopping for gifts for other people. So what are you giving yourself? And do not say a new toaster or a better dishwasher. Psychologist Elizabeth Dunn has a much better idea.
Tons of research has focused on the relationship between how much money we have and how happy we are. But we wanted to examine whether maybe people could use their money differently to get more happiness from their money, whether they had a little or a lot of it.
Differently how?
Well, for one thing, people pour lots of money into material things, but research suggests that it's actually better to buy experiences. For example, people get more lasting happiness from things like vacations, special meals, concerts, than from couches, televisions, things that surprisingly stick around, ironically, don't actually provide us lasting happiness.
Are some experiences better than others? I mean, do some kinds of experiences produce more lasting happiness than others?
Yeah. For one thing, experiences tend to be particularly rewarding when they bring us closer to other people. For example, I just got back from a surfing trip with my husband. We brought along our 9-month baby, our nanny, and some of our friends. And it was just such a great opportunity to be out there in the surf with my husband and my friends, especially being a busy working mother, like getting the chance to reconnect with those people who are important to me, I think delivered a kind of happiness boost that doing a similar trip solo simply couldn't.
So this is good news probably for travel agents and hotels and resorts and companies that market anything having to do with travel. Not so much good news for companies that create products, couches, televisions.
Right. Although, interestingly, when you think about it, many products fall somewhere along the continuum from something that's clearly a material thing to something that's clearly an experience. So the new wetsuit that I bought this weekend, it's a material thing, but what it allows me to do is stay in the freezing cold Canadian water surfing. And it turns out that if you can actually think about a material thing in terms of the experiences that it provides, you're more likely to get lasting happiness from that thing.
Now, you've also done some research suggesting that we use money to buy time. Can you explain what you mean?
Yeah. So the idea here is that before you reach for your wallet, you should try to ask yourself, will this purchase change how I spend my time? So, for example, buying that apartment closer to work, that's going to change the way that you spend your time because you're not going to be spending 2 hours a day commuting. But many of the products that we buy, many things that I myself find very tempting, you know, when I walk into Kate Spade and see a really cute new dress that I want, I have to kind of stop and ask myself, okay, is this actually going to change the way I spend my time? And the answer is probably not. And I would argue that if a product isn't going to have a positive impact on the way we spend our time, it might not be worthwhile.
But that sort of suggests that, I don't know, the people who spend money on house cleaning services are happier than people who scrub their own bathrooms.
Personally, I think that house cleaning services are a great use of money. My husband likes to say that although our tiny little kitchen, it could fit on a ship, it takes me like 45 minutes to clean it. And so for me, hiring a house cleaner is actually a good use of money. There are people, strangely enough, who I know who enjoy cleaning. The time that they spend cleaning is almost like meditational time for them. So I think the overall principle that I think is supported by science is that we should use our money to improve the way we spend our time. The nature of that improvement, of course, idiosyncratically depends on people's own particular preferences.
Well, and I guess the point being that there can be hidden time costs to certain purchases. Somebody who, I don't know, spends the money to get an in-ground pool, for instance, they might think, oh, I'm going to be so happy. The kids and I are going to hang out and swim every day, except then they've forgotten how much extra maintenance time it's going to take.
Absolutely. So one thing that we suggest is that people apply what we call the Tuesday test. And the question is, how will this purchase change the way I spend my time next Tuesday? So this very simple test turns out to de-bias our predictions about how much something will impact our happiness. When we think about buying a pool, for example, we're likely to kind of by default imagine that once a summer pool party where we gather the whole extended family and have a wonderful barbecue and make margaritas and it's all wonderful. And what we forget is that on the typical Tuesday, what we're going to be doing is rushing home from work to clean the pool. We're not actually going to have time to swim in it. And so thinking about what our time is actually like on just a typical average day can be very helpful in weeding out those purchases that might have little impact or even a negative impact on our happiness.
You bring up a term I really like that I hadn't really thought about before, time affluence. And once I began thinking about it, I thought, wow, that's just such a fascinating way to think about your life. Are you time rich or time poor? And of course, I think most Americans these days feel increasingly time poor. And you pointed out that I think some large companies are actually beginning to experiment with this in terms of what they can give their employees. They may not be able to pay them more, but they might be able to give them a greater sense of time affluence.
Exactly. And I think this is really a fascinating area for companies to explore. One thing that ironically makes us feel more time affluent is to give our time away for free. The more valuable our time seems, the scarcer it actually feels. So when we give it away by volunteering to help somebody, that can actually make us feel more time affluent. Some companies are beginning to provide their employees with the opportunity to engage in volunteer work, and sometimes, you know, on their own time, not during the workday. And this actually seems to be remarkably effective in terms of promoting employees' well-being.
Well, there's been a fair amount of research, hasn't there, that giving to other people in any way increases your personal sense of happiness. So it would seem like that would be the reason.
Exactly. I mean, we think of humans as being relatively selfish creatures, and that's not untrue, but we do have a more selfless side as well. And I think it's possible to really harness the emotional benefits that we get from giving to others.
You know, we've all heard that before, but you reference one of the more unusual studies I've read. This one was about dodgeball players.
Yeah. So my collaborators and I have conducted research with dodgeball players, and we asked the members of dodgeball teams to spend some money. We gave them some money. And on some teams, we said, we just want you to spend this money on yourself. On other teams, we told people that we wanted them to spend the money on their team members. This is a very small study, and it should be taken with a grain of salt. But we found intriguing evidence that dodgeball teams actually won more games when team members had the opportunity to spend money on each other rather than on themselves.
So spending on other people doesn't just improve your own happiness. It might make you a better dodgeball player.
Exactly, which, as we know, is the ultimate outcome that all of us care about.
Elizabeth Dunn is a professor of psychology at the University of British Columbia. She's the co-author of Happy Money, The Science of Happier Spending. To the Best of Our Knowledge is our gift to you every week from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Charles Monroe Kane produced today's show with help from Mark Rickers, Shannon Henry Kleiber, and Angelo Bautista. Joe Hartke is our sound designer and technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strange-Shamps. Now go shopping.